everyone to this week's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is going to focus on the power of Republican state legislator support for carbon pricing. Recent initiatives in Utah, Oregon, Delaware, and beyond have successfully gained the support of conservative state-level legislators to publicly support carbon pricing policy principles, including the Energy Innovation Act. So we're going to join this training tonight to hear directly from those CCL leaders on the field who've been building these successful relationships and learn how you too can best leverage this momentum in your own climate endorsement and conservative outreach work. To get us through tonight's actual lineup, we're going to be joined by three wonderful CCL state coordinators. We're going to hear from Tom Moyer and Utah's story first. We'll then go over to Oregon and hear from Danella Broad, our Oregon state coordinator. And after Danella, we'll have Beth Chagas, Delaware's fearless state coordinator as well, to line us up on what's going on the East Coast. And if we've done our job well, we're going to have a chance to review what's been working, ask questions from these key CCL leaders, and learn how to best apply that leverage in your own momentum with your climate conservative outreach. So again, a reminder, we're going to start with Utah, pivot to Oregon, go through Delaware, and then end with some next step recommendations for all of us in our own states, regardless of where we may be calling in. But to begin, I'll actually stop sharing and we'll jump in to talking through Utah's story with Tom taking it from here. So thank you all for joining us, and you're in for a real treat.
Thank you all. Glad to be here. So we have passed recently, or not passed, I'm sorry. We got a group of 25 legislators to author an op-ed supporting carbon pricing. It was a fee and dividend op-ed. It was not specifically an Energy Innovation Act op-ed. It does talk about rolling back regulations, and it's written explicitly from a conservative perspective. And I'll just tell you a little bit about how this came to be and why we did this now. This is something we would have loved to have done years ago. I don't think we were ready to, and I wasn't sure we were ready to now. To some degree, we were taking chances and we got lucky. Sometimes things break your way. And we, with the recent activity going on and obvious support for fee and dividend policies from Senator Romney, we felt like now was the time we really needed to pull out all the stops and get whatever endorsements, high level value endorsements we can to show him. So, you know, we've been working on business leaders, we've been working on state legislators, we've been working on all kinds of options in the state. And because of previous efforts we'd made with the state legislature, we have a bunch of good ongoing relationships. And I want to emphasize how much of this is just like everything else we do in CCL. We get to know people, we build relationships for the long term, we don't beat people up, and if we don't get what we're asking for from them right away, we don't go away and we don't give up. So many of the people we're talking to, we've been talking to for years, and we've worked with on other pieces of legislation before, and we've had at events, we've had on panels, things like that. So in our state right now, we've got, in addition to this op-ed, we also have John Curtis's Conservative Climate Caucus going on, and that's equally big. So there's a lot of climate in the news on the Republican side, and Curtis has been doing a fantastic job of outreach to other Republican members of Congress. They are not where we want them to be on carbon pricing. They're not going anywhere near that big right now, but he's bringing a bunch of people into the conversation. So this seems like a really opportune time for us to, with our state legislators, go a fairly big step further than our members of Congress are willing to go. So we started this process with, and Brett, you asked me to talk about, you know, what was our process like making a target list. We know a lot of the legislators in the state already. We know we have a pretty good idea of who's environment leaning. There is a bipartisan Clean Air Caucus in the Utah legislature, and we often attend those, and that's where a lot of the friendliest Republicans can be found. By the way, the Utah legislature is heavily Republican dominated. It's something like 78% Republican. The Clean Air Caucus is about 50-50 in that. So it's a lot of the Democratic caucus and then the more environmentally minded Republicans. What was really interesting about this process is that target list was not as rich as we thought it would be. It was where we got our first signers, but a lot of those legislators are also, they're on the moderate end, ideologically, of the Republican Party. They're in swing districts, and they're very cautious about not stepping too far out from their leadership. So it was actually really, really tough in the beginning to get yeses from that group. So I'll tell you, the first yes we got was from one member of the Utah legislature who was also a CCL member, and we talk all the time. And before this, we had never asked him for an endorsement of fee and dividend because we didn't want him sticking out alone. We thought if we were ever going to go to that step, we need to get him some company. And so we started this process with him, and we started it saying, we don't have you any company yet, but we want to start here, and then we're going to try and get you some company. So he actually endorsed the Energy Innovation Act, and his name is on the Energy Innovation Act webpage. And we promised him at the time, we're not going to go public with this. Your name will be on the webpage, but we're not going to make a bunch of noise about it until we can get you some more company. So then it was a big project of putting the word out to CCL members. There's 104 Utah legislators. So we've got, you know, we don't have active CCL members in all of those districts by any means, but we have people in a lot of them. And we have worked to get people in as many districts as possible to have contact with their legislators. So then it was just a question of picking that target list, which started out as being like a half a dozen, and putting the word out to one or two CCL members in each of those districts and saying, would you please ask your legislator for a meeting? And the ask in the meeting is going to be, would you be willing to endorse the Energy Innovation Act or sign a statement supporting carbon pricing? And about this time, the Energy Innovation Act got reintroduced with Democrats only, and it became less Republican leaning, less bipartisan in its language. And so we switched our ask away from asking for endorsements for that bill and towards just a generic fee and dividend, a more Republican leaning fee and dividend ask. So we spent months with no second yes. And we finally got one from somebody I had never heard of. And it was one of the CCL members who we had initially asked happened to be neighbors with a former legislator. Republican moderate, friendly to the environment, frustrated with his party on climate change. And he gave us an enthusiastic yes. And then it was beating the bushes trying to get number three. And we got a whole bunch of no's from people I thought would be yeses. And my guess is because they didn't want to stick out. And finally, we got three and four in the same week. We got three with somebody we thought was going to be supportive. We just hadn't been able to get a hold of him. He wasn't getting back to us. And then four with somebody we were almost certain would be supportive. But again, we didn't want him out there alone, and we thought he was going to be cautious, and we didn't want to ask until there were some other names already there. So those four all said yes enthusiastically, and they said, we're going to help you shop this around to our colleagues. So then it was like, okay, we have enough. We're going ahead with this now. This is no longer speculative. We're going to do it. So then we worked all together with those four legislators on the language of a statement, which became an op-ed, and got something that they were all comfortable with. And then we just went and shopped it around. And after that, the process was really pretty easy. It was, you know, either was in some cases, it was send a legislator an email asking for a meeting. It was in other cases, it was just, here's the text of the op-ed. Here's the list of signers. Are you willing to add your name? And it was like 5 minutes of effort, you know, after having absolutely busted our tails to get the first couple. It just became easier and easier. And then by pretty much nothing I can attribute to more than good luck, we got some pretty persuasive high value folks who are not Republican moderates, right? Who are far more conservative and respected statewide. And they put the word out to their friends. And that's what really got the ball rolling. And then by the end, you know, it was like, if we ever got a no, it was like, wait, are you sure? What? when we started this process, I was going to be thrilled if we got half a dozen. And the first time somebody said we should try for a dozen, I almost told them, like, that can't be done. That's impossible. So by the time we got to a dozen, then I was emailing the newspaper saying, is there an upper limit to how many people you can have on an op-ed? And their answer was, nope, go for it. So here's the things I wanted to remind myself to talk about. It was super hard in the beginning, super easy in the end. CCL relationships are the key to everything, just as we always do. We had a good message, a message that appealed to a Republican audience, and that was, you know, with a lot of work to get it right. The legislators needed some company before joining. They needed to see friends. And I think the timing is right, that people were looking for something to sign on to and a statement to make right about now, and we didn't know that. I cannot emphasize enough how many exclamation points there were in the yeses that we got. I have never seen that in my entire life of doing work with CCL. people were so enthusiastic to be on board and be for something and not just against everything. And I think it's part of that is where the Republican Party is right now. Republicans are frustrated, many of them, with the state of the party, and they want to be putting forward solutions and growing the party, appealing to young people, being more forward-looking. And this was a way for them to do that. And then my last point there was, look beyond the moderates, look beyond the known environmentalists among the Republicans. I could not believe the breadth that we got within the Republican Party. And that, for people who know Utah and know the names on that op-ed, that is really, really head-turning beyond just the number of people who are on board. It's the districts we got them from, some of the reddest districts in the state and a couple of rural districts. And I mean, like many states, there's almost more of an urban-rural split in Utah politics than there is a Republican-Democrat split. The environmentalist Republicans are all urbans. So getting a couple of rural Republicans on board is a big deal politically for where this is going to go. So I want to be clear that just because we got 25 Republican signers on an op-ed does not mean we have 100% support in the state. the Governor's Office of Energy Development has already put out a statement opposing the op-ed. And it's got some significant opposition. So our goal now is to leverage this into broader acceptance among the parts of the state that are still not on board. So we're already working on an op-ed for CEOs that will hopefully reinforce this. That's going to be our next big project. And then with the help of the CCLDC office, we're going to do a media tour next week. So we're going to do some appearances on conservative media. That'll be myself, our conservative outreach fellow, Hunter Thomas, and then one of the signers of the op-ed, Jonathan Johnson.
Thanks, Brett. And Tom, I loved hearing your story. And for the intellectual in me, it's like a perfect sort of mirror image sort of what Oregon is. You talked a lot about how your context was that climate was in the news from the Republican side. In Oregon, climate was in the news on the Democrat side. There was no climate news about Republicans other than Republicans had left the state 2 years ago in protest of a very democratically driven cap and invest, driven by the environmental organizations here, set a bill, a carbon pricing bill. And you probably all have heard of that. And then I also want to mention, like, you talked about urban and rural In Oregon, everybody who's urban is basically Democrat legislators, and everybody's rural is Republican legislators. So we're divided that way. And then we don't have a lot of shared power in Oregon. Basically, like 2/3 of the legislature are Democrats and 1/3 of it is Republicans. And that matters in the big picture here. So if you're a state that kind of is, the balance of power is like that and you're mostly blue, my story might be sort of relevant to you. And so I guess I'll just start with, how did we generate our list of targets? Well, because we already had our history of cap and invests and stuff, well, our targets were, who do we already know who's supportive of climate action? And we're going after Democrats, and we're going after the ones we already know, and they're our friends, and they're easy to get. And we started like getting those as EICDA endorsers. And then when we were in those meetings, like, who else should we talk to? And so we just started just plowing through. Like, we just plowing through. We're like 15, 18, 22. Like, then in that process, one of the lame duck legislators at the end of 2020, she had lost her election, said, hey, you know what we should do? We should do a state resolution. And we're like, yeah, sounds great. And so she actually typed it up herself as she was exiting and submitted it in early January to Legislative Council in Oregon. It was a really key step, like, I think. Like, we set up a bipartisan passage committee. Like, this committee is not going to just go get a resolution that is going to be all Democrats, because we could have done a resolution that was all Democrats in Oregon. But we've made an intention about having a team that was focused on bipartisan passage. And so what that meant is you have to have somebody on the team that represents both sides, or people in general. No, you have to have people on both sides. So you populate a team that will represent the broad swath. Then we had already started reaching out to a Republican House legislator. And the way we did that, and it only just sort of happened, that a very driven, focused, like, climate advocate who is Democrat, had been involved in state climate stuff for years before, had found CCL, and I invited her to reach out to Christine Drazen, who happened to be her legislator. So we had this really interesting, nice conversation with her. She'd clearly done her homework. Soon after that, we're on this resolution path, and we're asking her if she wants to get on board with this resolution. We called in the big guns. We called in, through Eric Means, we asked Bob Inglis if he would have a conversation with Christine Drazen, just to help her with her comfort level. And so I think this is where it went through the Senate first, and so it had to go to the Senate hearing first. And I think, Brett, this is where it would be a good place to show Christine Drazen's testimony. So we had five people ready to testify, but first that Democrat who had submitted the resolution, who was a lame duck, she testified, and as a House leaving Democrat. And then right after her, Christine Drazen, the head of the Republicans, testified. So we're feeling really awesome now, like this testimony. So let's show the testimony.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christine Drazen. I am State Representative for House District 39 and a mile, and I'm also the House Republican leader. And I am here today in support of Senate Joint Memorial 5. A year ago today, I spoke out in committee in opposition to Oregon's adoption of a cap and trade program. And today, I am honored to be with you in support of an alternative. My concerns with Oregon's proposed bill were pretty straightforward for me personally. It would raise prices, disrupt a stable economy, hurt competitiveness for Oregon businesses, and harm the poor. I believe then and believe now that adopting a state-level bureaucracy to a global crisis was not and is not the answer. But legislation before Congress now in the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act could be. and it deserves their full consideration. The act is not punitive, it is not regressive, it does not pick winners and losers among the American people, and instead provides an equal monthly dividend to everyone with an ITIN or an EIN and their dependents to offset increased costs of goods and services. The distribution of this dividend, not to energy producers, but to consumers directly, allows the act to be revenue neutral and does not expand the federal government bureaucracy. The act exempts the diesel fuel that farmers rely on to raise our food on their farms. It recognizes the impacts of the new carbon fee and not only pauses EPA regulations on emissions, but also creates a border carbon adjustment to protect jobs and families. The act acknowledges the value of carbon sequestration and doubles down on this notion that if carbon dioxide can be captured or scrubbed out of an emission source and then sequestered in a permanent form, that it doesn't actually contribute to global warming. I think this is brilliant. The Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act provides a refund for those companies that collect and sequester CO2 produced by coal, oil, or natural gas. The refund would be equal to the carbon fee that was in place when the CO2 itself was created. The CO2 capture and sequestration could be applied to any power plant or manufacturing process that burns coal, oil, or natural gas and vents the CO2 to the atmosphere. Another possible application could be ammonia fertilizer manufacturers, where pure CO2 coming out of the process is often released into the atmosphere but could be compressed and sent to a pipeline that carries it to a sequestration site. This provision in the bill allows carbon capture and sequestration facilities on a level playing field with low carbon energy technologies like wind, solar, power, hydro, nuclear. The act does not hold back funding from the dividends to subsidize or fund private sector research, but simply allows private companies to determine for themselves if they judge the carbon price justifies investing in carbon capture and sequestration. I'm a fourth generation Oregonian, and I believe in this state and her future. I have the privilege of serving the legislature to do my part to solve problems and help people. And like the generations of Republican leaders before me, I believe in the values of conservation and stewardship. I also believe in working together for the common good. And when we have the opportunity to work together to support a balanced approach to the challenges that we share, we should take it. The Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act is not perfect, but it is an opportunity and we shouldn't squander it. It's an opportunity for Congress to stop playing small ball on climate. It's an opportunity to level the playing field for businesses that operate under the onerous state level regulations that we have put on energy in our own state. It's an opportunity to recognize Oregon's innovations and contributions to our nation's low carbon future, to support access to reliable, affordable, low carbon energy sources and incentivize carbon sequestration. This is an opportunity to urge Congress to act on a proposal that supports our shared commitment to steward Oregon's unrivaled land, air, and water without sacrificing jobs or putting families or our economy at risk. For the skeptics, and there are many, I would like to acknowledge the dangers that are present in such sweeping reforms. The devil is always in the details, and this act is not yet finalized. But as the process continues to move forward, I would encourage our congressional colleagues to resist burdening the act with bureaucratic bloat, preferential treatment, pork spending, or backroom deals, and instead hold to the strength of a clear proposal that reduces emissions, protects consumers, encourages private sector innovation, and with that, I feel confident we can maintain bipartisan support. In closing, I would like to thank Elizabeth Gracer Lindsay, my opponent from my 2018 campaign. Elizabeth introduced me to the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. She was willing to reach out to me when issues mattered to her. She refused to be drawn into fear or anger and instead built bridges across party lines while persistently advocating for bipartisan progress on climate. And for that, I'm grateful. I urge your support today of Senate Joint Memorial 5. Thank you.
That is a glowing endorsement video that, if you haven't heard yet tonight, I'm sure was just sending chills for anyone listening in. So tell us more about the background and what you did with that next, Janella.
Yeah, so Brett asked for some templates that we use. So what? So it went through the hearing, and then I just want to let you know that it basically passed the Senate in a bipartisan vote, 23-5, with a majority or six Republicans voting for it and 100% of the Democrats. So that was, they got through the Senate. And then, so what we did for the templates about how to, we did a lot of like massive grassroots mobilizing with people that weren't traditionally or normally like normally involved in lobbying and all our other stuff. And so I've got templates that Brett can, will be able to share with you all. So we did things like, we have an email to we developed emails that went to all the group leaders for them to send to their membership, basically asking people to contact your legislature, your legislator, and say this, you know. The other thing that we had was right after this hearing, but before the Senate vote, we targeted CCL constituents in the Republican districts and said, basically, your voice asking your Republican senator to say something is in this broader context really important. And so this was a key thing. One of our members on our committee, our bipartisan committee, his name's Jerry Porter. He basically co-led the committee with me. He spent his time just sending specific individual emails to individual people that he didn't know, but inviting them to reach out to their legislator and saying, you know, let me know if you're interested, someone will help you. And he actually did a lot of like emailing back and forth. And then we were positioning ourselves then for the House process, getting into, we were awaiting it to get a hearing in the House. It's another story, but we basically never were given a hearing. And we were never given a vote in the House. But in the process of awaiting for that, we continued to gather co-sponsors or sponsors of the resolution. And so we do have records of House members who are Democrat, as well as at least five or six, I can't remember what, Republicans who have gone on record in support of this resolution. So were there any key resources or other resources you used? I can't build a team, meet regularly and frequently. We targeted a 30-minute meeting a week. And I already mentioned we used the Bob Inglis resource. And the other resource that we used a lot was our camaraderie and our humor. We did these email templates, they worked. I talked about some of the key steps. I learned about the power and importance of systems to engage grassroots CCLers often through the process. So set up your systems to just sort of engage them often. And I'll just say the last thing is that what we're gonna do to leverage these conservative endorsers are, we're developing a press release right now claiming victory basically on SJM5, even though it didn't get through, with a message of success that includes the statistics of how many Dems and how many Republicans did support it. And the other thing we're going to do is, this is where Utah comes in. You've been an inspiration for us. We're not going to do an op-ed, but we're going to do an open letter kind of modeled on the language in the Utah op-ed. And we're going to invite Republicans in Oregon who have shown support to sign it. The purpose of it is to spread out beyond Oregon and be speaking to state legislators in other parts of the country. So that's what I have to say. I'm super excited and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
I'm really glad to be here along with these two stellar organizers. I'm going to take it down a little smaller scale because Delaware is a tiny little state. I've lived here for 30 years, but prior to that, I lived in big states. I lived in California and before that in Texas. And what I discovered when I moved to Delaware was that politics in a small state can be quite a different ballgame. There's much more retail in-person politics. Like if you run for the state legislature and you do not go door to door, you will probably not win. We have less than 1 million residents in three counties, but 2/3 of those residents live in the northern more urban county, which contains the largest city of Wilmington. And then there's just one congressional district that we all work together. So there's really a culture of close contact with our elected officials. And we also have a long tradition of moderate politics. There's a bit of a revolving door that happens with various statewide positions. For example, our senior Senator Carper used to be our governor, and our current governor used to be our congressman. And after elections, we still hold a ceremony where we literally bury a hatchet, a real life hatchet in the ground, and everyone is then supposed to get along. We also have our junior Senator Coons, who's been designated the most bipartisan Democrat in the Senate by Politico. And as many of you know, he's also been a real key player in supporting and promoting bipartisan climate solutions, the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus in the Senate. And he did introduce the EICDA along with Jeff Flake in the 115th Congress. But like similar stories to Oregon, there has been some polarization and some division in the state, and it's kind of on a north-south divide here, with about, as I mentioned, two-thirds of the population living in the more urban northern county, which is highly Democrat, and the rest of the lower two counties are much more rural and red. The northern county is really part of the Philadelphia metro area, essentially. And currently, we're one of the few states in the nation, I guess Oregon is another one, where all the statewide offices are occupied by Democrats. And we have super majorities of Democrats in both chambers of our legislature, which has 21 seats in the Senate and 41 in the House. So Republicans who manage to hold office in the northern county tend to be more moderate in their positions on things like energy and the environment than their southern counterparts. So how did we begin working on engaging these legislators, especially the Republican ones? Well, as of late last summer, we had what I considered to be a rather low number of endorsements. We just had 9 total in our EICDA website endorsement map, and I think maybe only 2 or 3 of them were legislators at the time. So at our August chapter meeting, in addition to being a state coordinator, I'm also group leader for this northernmost county chapter, the Wilmington-Newark chapter. And I wanted to change the situation. So I challenged my volunteers to double that number of endorsements prior to our December lobby meetings. And I think the key message there was to say to everyone at the meeting, and our meetings, we have 300 on our roster, but a typical meeting is 10 to 12 people attending. So I said to those 10 to 12 people in attendance, imagine how it would feel to go into our lobby meetings in December, virtually, of course, and make that kind of announcement. We have doubled our number of endorsements since we last saw you. And that really did seem to catch fire, especially among a real core group of maybe 3, 4, or 5 people. And so I'm proud to say that the chapter met the challenge by just well before December. And in fact, within 1 month, we met that doubling of challenge, and it's gone on from there. And we now have 25 endorsements, 11 are local elected officials, including 3 Republicans and 6 Democratic state legislators. And one of the Democrats is the Senate pro tem, so the leading Democrat in the state. And we've also gotten along the way a county councilwoman and the county executive of our northern county as endorsers. So I especially wanted to acknowledge 2 of my volunteers, Marty Hopkins and Jill Gomer, because they have been absolutely key in setting up most of the meetings. And at least one of them has been present at every single meeting that we've held. And we have received pretty few no's so far. So we have a lot of meetings still left ahead of us, a lot of people we could tap into, but our success rate has been pretty high. The first connections were made by those 2 contacting their own local state legislators. So Marty got our first endorsement with his own Democratic representative in the state house. And Jill got our first Republican with her own Republican state senator. So my advice on this is to really start with this low-hanging fruit, the people that you have the closest relationships with, people who are most excited about contacting them. We just reach out with emails. We don't really have a template to those, but I could give you a number of elements that I think are really important to include in each email. One is to play up that previous relationship or contact that you've had with them, to express appreciation for something that they've done before. Offer them a brief explanation of the EICDA with links for them to learn more about it and more about CCL if they choose prior to the meeting. And then explain that you are seeking their endorsement specifically, or at least that you're seeking local endorsements generally, so you're not catching them completely by surprise with your ask. And if possible, mention some of their colleagues who have already endorsed. And then just ask for a short period of their time. Usually we ask for half an hour. Once we go in, we treat them, we treat the preparation for these meetings very much like we would treat a congressional lobby meeting. We make a plan, we have different roles assigned to different people. We really do try to bring constituents, as has been mentioned, because it does make a little bit of a difference. A lot of times they are not the most experienced people in the room. So what we often ask them to do is to either offer the appreciation or to, and also to explain why they're there, why this issue is important to them and that they would really like to see something done. And often that is, the emotional heart of the meeting. However, we have done some meetings where we haven't had constituents and found that it's not always completely essential, because state legislators are used to meeting with representatives of different organizations. So we have been successful in getting some meetings without constituents there and having a positive outcome. We have also prepared some short slide presentations to use in our meetings, one of which is specifically targeted with language towards Republicans and the other towards Democrats. And I'm going to share a link to those. They're in Google Slides with Brett so that you can access them yourself. And there will need to be, of course, the adaptations. They quickly go out of date because things have changed. There have been more endorsements, or there have been different aspects of the bill that change, or just it needs to be updated and personalized for each situation. And we just remember that, if there is a lot of inertia in the beginning, like it's that first one, as Tom mentions, really kind of hard to get going, but it can be really fun and it can really energize your chapter and bring people together. And it really feels great to watch your totals growing on your endorsement map. And if you just remember that your elected officials are working for you, especially if you have a constituent present, they will aim to please their voters. They don't want to say no to you if they can help it. And so you can use that to your advantage in these meetings. And if you don't get that yes right away, just keep following up with that polite CCL persistence, every few weeks, and just to see if there's any more questions you can answer, or let them know if you have a new colleague that's endorsed, little things like that to kind of keep that conversation going.
No, thank you, Beth, so much. And obviously a huge, huge applause to all of your work, Beth, all of Janela's work, all of Tom, the whole teams that have been behind these three featured states. And if I had to summarize the final takeaways really based on all of your collective experience into three distilled bullets, it would be these. You want to start by assembling a motivated team. It can be a small group, it can be a big crew. Set an inspiring goal and then really build out that support structure to have a regular check-in with each other to keep moving the ball forward and provide that support that each other needs. From that, you want to create a broad list of your network of the leads that you have and the personal connections that you can bring to really begin pursuing those asks for initial support on. Now, it sounds like the first one can often be the hardest, but really broadening that list, being open to expecting unexpected leads. And then lastly, having the construct of a joint letter, an op-ed, an endorsement campaign, whatever works for your local group to really collectively organize around a public effort is absolutely key to bring in one voice and then another to really be part of this larger statement that might be issued. And if you do need any help, especially on that front, I know that we've put links in the chat as well as in the speaker notes for those listening in later to all of these outreach emails, presentations, op-eds. If you want to get inspiration for what's been working with other groups, then definitely check out the presentation slides tonight. All of the speaker notes have that. And you can always email me or post in the forums any questions that you have here too. That's really the big thing that we want to uplift tonight is just that there are examples out there. This is very achievable work. It is a labor of love, but with the right vision and the right team surrounding you, it's absolutely accomplishable, and we can shift the dial in each of the states that we're at. So thank you so much, Tom, Danella, and Beth. Have a wonderful rest of your nights, everyone, and I'm going to make sure everyone get unmute so we can celebrate in style. Here we go.
Yay.
Thanks. Stay cool, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.